Welcome to the CGOE Sports Show podcast. On this episode, we learn more about the CFL Combine with Marshall Ferguson from TSN. Plus, what does it take to be an education advisor in the Western Hockey League? Well, we'll tell you. Glenda Zelmer of the Brandon Wheat Kings just named the league's Distinguished Service Award winner. She joins us on the podcast. I want to bring in our next guest, Marshall Ferguson. He is a TSN play-by-play man for the CFL, does a lot of work with the CFL draft as well, and the CFL Combine being in Winnipeg this week. We bring in Marshall to talk. Marshall, this is your first time on the show. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So are you in Winnipeg for the draft, or are you following it remotely?
No, I am. I am here. We are actually going to be doing the live stream coming up. It'll be on CFL Plus, which everybody can access from CFL.ca over the next couple of days. We are live tomorrow for the bench press from the Fort Garry Hotel. And then, of course, we're going to be on the 40-yard dash coming up on Thursday evening. And then Sunday, myself and Dwayne Ford will have all the padded practice coverage for everybody. So it's real football in the middle of the winter, which is going to be exciting to see here in Winnipeg.
So these are the marquee combine activities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the best opportunity to kind of get your football fix, I think, for a lot of people in the middle of the winter, right? I think a lot of people look at the combine as being, you know, downplayed, or it's not the most important thing or all the rest. But for me, it's just a great opportunity to kind of look into the future and see these guys that have put so much work into kind of honing their craft. And, you know, as a former university athlete, when I played at McMaster University back about a decade ago, I kind of gained an appreciation for the amount of work that goes into shaping and crafting your body to try and give off the very best effort that you can in front of scouts and GMs and coaches, and all the pressure that comes with that is you basically spend, you know, 3, 4, 5 months working in silence around a bunch of your teammates on your campus or getting together with guys that are in your area. And then you show up and all of a sudden you throw on some combine gear and you go out and you put pads on and you practice and you lay down the fastest dives that you can. And the numbers say one thing, the on-field actual elements of it, I think, say completely different. And then there's also the interview process as well, which the great mystery of all of this is that we never really know what the interview process is like or how it goes, other than the cameras that are stuck in some of the interview rooms with specific teams that get clearance from CFL.ca. So there's so many elements of this, I think, that add into what happens on draft night. And my favorite part of the combine is just kind of seeing the buzz that builds around certain players as the week goes on, because you start to hear more and more about, okay, yeah, this guy measured him really well, or wow, he's a really good kid, he interviewed great, or wow, did you see that 40-yard dash time? And when you start to have all of those different elements add up, that's where you start to go, okay, this person's probably going to be very highly thought of come the end of April.
I know you got into broadcasting real quick after you were done your university career. Did you ever get to participate in the combine?
You know, I went to the Eastern Regional Combine. At the time, it was not the Invitational Combine that it is now. It was kind of, you know, you would go to the Ontario Regional, the Eastern Regional, or the Western Regional, which were held in Toronto, Montreal, and Edmonton, respectively. And I was asked to come out and actually compete in the Combine. I was very self-aware, and I knew after going with the CFL quarterback internship program, where U Sports, at the time CIS quarterbacks, get to go into different CFL training camps and work as if you are actually a member of the team. I did that with Calgary in 2013. So when it was my turn to kind of come out and have a look, I got asked to come out and I said, I'm going to come throw. I'll come help you guys. I'd love to go sling the rock around and play a little bit of football with some of the best receivers in the country. I know I'm not going to play in the CFL. So I'm just going to, I said, I'm going to go throw and have fun and get to meet some people. And I never really knew or felt like I had the opportunity to go and push it forward. So very, very fortunate to get an opportunity to still be around the game that I love on the microphone. And I love coming to these combine settings because I have so much respect for each and every athlete that actually does have the ability to push their limits and to try and make it into the league, because I certainly was not one who thought that was a reality by the end of my playing career.
So this week specifically, are there a few athletes that you were really looking forward to seeing at the event?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, there's a couple of guys that jump out for a couple of different reasons. One is Kevin Mattal, who's a receiver from Laval. And anytime you talk about the Laval Rouge Or, it's a national powerhouse university program. you're always going to have marquee players. They are a little bit emblematic, I think, of the shift that's happening in Canadian university football and by consequence, really the CFL Combine and the CFL Draft, which is this used to be a combine and a draft process that was based around linemen. It was get the biggest, best offensive lineman that you can out of Montreal or Quebec or Western, and that's your first round pick. More and more, we've seen this draft trending towards receivers, defensive backs, running backs that are being taken higher and higher and higher. And the reason for that, I think, is that the skill positions, if you want to call them that, not that there's not skill involved with offensive and defensive linemen, but they're becoming more athletic, more developed, more refined. They're catching up, I think, to some of their counterparts from down in the NCAA. So Kevin Mitall, to me, is a great symptom of that because he plays in a program where it used to just be you can go there and you can pick any of their three offensive linemen on their starting five and they'll be first-round picks for you. Mitall is he's a legitimate threat to be a high-end top first-round pick based on his 2022 season. 2023, he had some injuries. He had some off-the-field struggles. And so now he's coming into this combine. There's going to be a lot of questions about, okay, are you the guy from 2022 who won the Hec Crichton as the outstanding university player in Canada? Or are you the guy in 2023 that struggled and is going to come into our training camp and be underwhelming? And so I'm really interested to see how he approaches this whole process. And then the other one for me that kind of jumps off the page on defense is that you've got a couple of defensive linemen from the OUA in Ontario that I find really interesting. One of them is Owen Hubert, who I think is a really underrated pass rusher. He's out of McMaster, and I'm not saying this because I went to McMaster, but I've talked to a lot of people around the league who think he's got the movement skills to play a variety of different positions. And then Luke Brubaker is another one from Wilfrid Laurier, who I called the Yates Cup this past year when Laurier was competing at Western. And a lot of people thought that Luke was going to, you know, not play in the game. He was banged up. He had, you know, gone through a lot throughout the season. He was only in there in situational pass rushing setups where it was, you know, second and long and he had to get off to the quarterback. You knew it was almost always going to be a passing down. And he ended up still finding a way to create pressure because he's got such a great variety of pass rush moves. So I think, you know, when you're talking about a receiver, you got a couple of defensive ends, there's a bunch of really athletic linebackers. I think you're going to see a couple of offensive linemen as well that will separate themselves in the one-on-ones throughout the weekend. Maybe even a Ryan Berta from Queens is one that jumps out to me that I've seen from his game film. So, yeah, there's a lot of good players that are here at the Combine, and I think the energy and enthusiasm on a Wednesday is it's really easy for everybody to harness. On a Thursday, you start to go through the testing. By the time that you actually put the pads on Friday, my experience in this event is it gets very real very quickly, and guys start to realize, oh, yeah, I had heard about this player who's in my positional group, but now I'm actually competing side-by-side against him. Or, you know, I'm a receiver and I'm going up against defensive back who I've seen on game film, but, man, he's a lot different in person. He's way more physical than I thought. So it does happen quickly, but that's the excitement of all this event.
Do combine results offer a predictor into the future, or do teams have to be careful overreacting to what they see this week?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one that I constantly ask myself. You know, I went back when I started kind of falling in love with the combine process, and as somebody who really appreciated what some of the people who work in media were doing down south covering the National Football League, I decided to archive basically every testing score at every position that I could find dating back over the last 20, now 25 years almost, dating back to 2000 or so. And what's so intriguing to me is that you will essentially punch all of these in and put players into a percentile, right? So if I'm a wide receiver and I run a 4.85 40-yard dash, that's decent. It's not good. It's really not top end. You know, it's going to, you would think, drop you down because teams and coaches and evaluators are going to say, well, you're not running the 40-yard dash that we need you to run. You can't separate. And therefore, you're not going to get open. You can't play in this offense. And they drop you down their draft rankings. But if you turn on their game film as the same receiver and they're just always open, then that will constantly reopen the eyes of everybody who's making those decisions. What I love about the combine is once it's done, we don't have the CFL draft this year. It's usually the first Tuesday in May. This year it's April 30th. You still have a month. You have more than a month in which to be able to evaluate what you got out of this CFL combine before you have to actually write the final test for all of these teams, which is CFL draft night. What I love about this is that everybody that I talked to with this combine, from every single team, without any oddities, they say, we are taking the information that we got here, and it will educate us on what to do when we go home. Because they will go home and they'll either say, we need to watch more of this player because we're really intrigued by them and they're better than we thought they were based on their testing and their combine performance, or they'll see somebody that they really love, they'll see their testing numbers, they'll go back, and they'll have to reevaluate and say, we might have missed something here, guys. We got to watch a little bit more film on this player. So it constantly sends people back to the film, and then you have a month to come to your final determination on that player. One quick one that I'll throw out is the Philpott brothers that everybody knows, like Jalen and Tyson getting drafted to Calgary and to Montreal. We all know Tyson Philpott obviously had the great touchdown catch at the end of the Grey Cup this past November in Hamilton for the Alouettes as they won the Grey Cup. And those two guys didn't run as well as a lot of people thought. Their, you know, three cone score wasn't great. Their shuttle wasn't awesome. They didn't bunch a ton, all the rest. But you just watch them play football, and every single time they run a route, it's with precision and expertise, and they just get open and they catch everything. And so those guys didn't have a great combine, were still first-round picks, and have shown why they were first-round picks. So, yeah, it will send everybody back to evaluate you again over the next month, just like Calgary and Montreal did with the Philpott brothers, in order to figure out what is this player really.
It's all part of the imperfect science that is drafting in sports, right? You've got the game film on all these players, and then you've got the ability to look at them in testing, look at them in the practices they'll have this week, and then you get to talk to them a little bit. It's got to be hard to be a GM in the CFL. You got so many people to choose from, and there's a lot of pressure to get it right, especially if you're picking early in the first round.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I love the most about the CFL draft, and Dwayne Ford, who covers it as well on the CFL on TSN with me and will be with me on CFL Plus on Sunday afternoon for the broadcast and the live stream that people can access on CFL.ca, is the first round picks are quite often, in our opinion, reaches. They are people that are hyped, that are much discussed. There are games that are played that can sometimes fool teams into saying, well, we're afraid if we don't get this player, that team at number four is going to take them, and we have the second overall pick, so we should probably just take them right now. And the first round, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of anxiety. I think the best draft picks are the ones that come in the second and the third round. And in all honesty, again, this might just be me as somebody who played CIS, now U Sports football. There's a lot of incredible football players that are taken from U Sports schools in the second and the third round, that when you actually see the way that training camp plays out, those are usually the players that make the roster and that make an impact on those rosters. The first round players, yes, you can go out and get a Luol Ugoak, who was drafted by the Montreal Alouettes in the first round this past year, slips into the starting lineup halfway through the year, plays absolutely lights out, wins a Grey Cup, and signs a contract with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He is now in the National Football League, no longer with the Alouettes. They're okay with that for now because they drafted him and he performed well enough to get that notice and to get that opportunity. But there's so many players that get drafted in the first round where, to your point, it's a swing. You're hoping that they become the potential that you see in them, and there's never a guarantee in any of this stuff. And I even think about across the border, like watching Justin Fields get traded for essentially nothing to the Pittsburgh Steelers is incredible to me, that there's barely even a trade market for that guy. And you see that even more times 10 in the CFL, where you can draft somebody in the top five, and within 2 years, if they're not producing enough, you'll essentially get the swap of a late round pick for them. So if you have those high picks, you know, Edmonton's picking first overall as the draft order stands right now, you better have a good idea of where you want to go with that selection, and you better believe in the player and the person that you're getting, because if you don't and it doesn't work out, it's such a waste of roster building capital that I think people really do come to regret over time. And especially if you get it wrong, not just once, but maybe your second round pick isn't great, or you get your first round pick wrong 2 or 3 years in a row. If you come up empty handed and other teams don't, that's the difference between building a really talented roster and being on the outside of the playoffs looking in.
Marshall, appreciate your insight on this, and have yourself a fun week here in Winnipeg. Enjoy the combine.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
As Marshall Ferguson, you can find his work on the CFL on TSN, and he also does work for CFL.ca, as he mentioned, part of those live streams from the Combine. The WHL this past week announced the winner of this year's Distinguished Service Award, and it's going to someone here in Manitoba. Glenda Zellmer is the education advisor for the Brandon Wheat Kings and has been doing that for 15 years now. This past Saturday night, she was honored in Brandon by Commissioner Dan Neer for her service behind the scenes. Under the guidance of Zellmer, the Wheat Kings have seen two players win the WHL's Daryl K. Doc Seaman Memorial Trophy presented annually to the Scholastic Player of the Year. Quinn Mante and Tanner Kaspik have each won that in the last decade. And during the 21-22 season, Zellmer's tutelage led the Wheat Kings to being named the league-wide team of the year, scholastically, winners of the Jim Donlevy Memorial Trophy. Now, earlier today, Zellmer took some time out of her busy schedule and joined me to explain how somebody becomes an education advisor in the Western Hockey League.
Well, every team has to have an education advisor, and how I got into it was the previous person doing it, Mr. Bob Hamilton, had done it for many years here at Crocus Plains, and Crocus is usually the school for the Wheat Kings, mostly. Sometimes we do have a couple of the Wheat Kings that are already Brandon based, and some of them were attending Vincent Massey, the other high school, which is fine. But predominantly, any player new to the team would be attending Crocus. So Bob was here doing it for many years, and when he was starting to prepare for his retirement, he brought me in. I was already billeting at the time, so I was pretty familiar with the team and the concept, and I was also working with Bob down in student services, so I was pretty aware of the players and what was happening. So it was a good fit, so I did it with Bob for the first year, and then he retired, and I assumed the role.
Your job then as an education advisor, what are you tasked with doing? Is it a tutoring? Is it just making sure players are on top of things? What is it that you do?
Actually, there's a lot more to it than I think people understand. So we even start even before players become students here. So we start meeting with them when they're younger and maybe being drafted by the teams. Then they're automatically, I don't want to say assigned, but given our information so that they can start doing some pre-planning for their education in the event that they do become, in my case, a Brandon Wheat King, and possibly moving to Brandon, living here, transferring high schools, et cetera. So that once they make the team, then we are aware of their education. We're aware of where they're at with their credits, what they need to be working on to graduate from their home school. And what I mean by home school is I think people think that students come here, that they graduate from us, when in fact, our goal is that every player graduate on time and from their home province or home school. So, for example, I have students from BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan that I mostly work with. This year, I do have one from the States. So I'm tasked with the role of working with their home school from their home province, finding out where they're at academically, what they have left to do or meet the requirements for the graduation to walk across the stage at their home or previous school. Then I start working with them about how do we meet those needs or credits? How do we get those credits earned here in a timely manner? And that works around their schedule, their hockey schedule. So doing timetabling, credit or course planning, credit planning, grad planning, and also ensuring that they're meeting, like we want to make sure that all of our players leave their doors and options open. When I meet with the boys, I always talk about, yes, we all want to believe that hockey's going to pay your bills, but we also know realistically that may or may not happen. So in the event that they do end up going to any post-secondary, we want to make sure that all their doors and options are open. So taking the right credits and high-level credits to ensure that all their options are left available to them once their hockey career is ended or hockey careers transition to the CIAU or wherever they might attend post-secondary.
So is this, as an education advisor, a full-time job for you, or is it part of what you do for a living?
It's part of what I do. I'm actually a grade 12 counselor here at Crocus Plains. So these guys make up just a very small portion of my caseload or my students. But I also do study hall with them after the regular school hours. So I just did study hall yesterday. So they come back at the end of their day after the rink. So they come to me in the morning for at least 2 hours. Then they head over to the rink for their afternoon of practice or training or whatever their afternoon looks like. And then usually at least once, if not twice a week, they're coming back to me here at the school. And we started study hall yesterday from 3:30 till 5:30. So that makes a bit of a longer day for everybody. But that's just to ensure that with their traveling and everything else, that they're able to stay on top of their assignments and credits and do well in their courses.
So I take it you're pretty busy then.
It is. It's a good busy. It's constantly learning, making sure, and that's where it's nice because every team having an ed advisor, we really rely on each other to keep each other up to date with any changes that are happening within the provinces, any credits that are changing, any requirements that are changing. Saskatchewan has some changes coming in next year for their grade 12s, and so we need to be aware of those. And if we have questions about, you know, how do we get this course done or what's the best way to get this or whatever, we phone each other all the time from each team. So it's not always just about the players on your own team, but just knowing who's else is out there. And we help each other from province to province all the time. And we also have our main ed advisor through the WHL office, Stacey Meyer. And Stacey is a wealth of information because he works with every ed advisor from every team. So if I don't know who to contact or who I should be talking to, he puts me in touch with the right people if he doesn't already have that information.
So when you see one of the Wheat Kings being named the WHL Scholastic Player of the Year or the team being named the Scholastic Team of the Year, how much pride do you take in that?
Well, I'm proud of them, firstly, because it is not easy. I think people assume that these guys are given the easy credits or take the easy route. And when you read the list of credits these guys are able to complete in the scheduling that they have and the travel they have and the, you know, they get home at 3 a.m. They're here at school the next morning at 10 to 9 for the most part. And I don't think people always realize that. So I'm incredibly proud of their commitment, their ability to time management and just to complete those credits and high-end credits. Like Scholastic Player of the Year is not easy to do for sure. I mean, you're being compared to a lot of elite academic players. So, I mean, I'm incredibly proud of any player that does that when you see or hear their schedule and what their days and weeks look like. But as a team as a whole, I just feel it speaks so well to the organization. So I think if a parent hears that your son is being drafted by the Wheat Kings and that we take not just on ice seriously, but we take off ice seriously, I think that speaks well to that team and their commitment and the management and ownership that right from the top down, that's a very consistent message given to everybody.
Do you ever hear from players after they've graduated that they come back and thank you or anything like that?
I run into them. It's interesting how many will come back to this area to train in the summer or come back to reconnect with a lot of the players or, you know, guys that are from here and how many of them I do run into. Like I said, I used to billet, so I do hear from some of them. And interesting, I did hear from a couple of them when I won this award, how many of them had reached out, which is really nice. It's always great. And a couple of them are you'll see on TV playing hockey. So I always like to stay up to date on where their careers are at or just finding out where their paths take them is always fun. But yeah, it's nice when I run into them, nice when I hear from them and or reach out through social media. It's a great connection.
Yes, this award, the Distinguished Service Award from the Western Hockey League that you have received. How did you find out about this and what does it mean to you?
The new owner, Jared Jacobson of the Wheat Kings, he had contacted me in November to let me know that I had been nominated and had actually won it. I was shocked because it's something I've always enjoyed doing. This is my 15th year of doing it. And it's not, although it's not a paid position, it is payment in a way because it is very fulfilling. It's a neat part of my career and it's a different way of learning or a different type of work for me and I enjoy it. So I was really, truly honored, and especially knowing how many other people in this league work so hard to get these guys their credits and help them with that. I felt very privileged. And yeah, I was really honored that my own team and my own, you know, staff and ownership and everything else really recognized that.
So for you to be led out to center ice and honored before a game, what was that feeling like when you were out there?
Yeah, it was kind of disbelief. I mean, it was you know, something that I see. I go to, you know, 95 or 8% of the home game. So you see a lot of that happening. But until you're actually out there, you're not really aware of all the people and the eyes on you. So it was a little unnerving at first. And again, like I said, I'm not really used to the spotlight. So it was a little bit surreal, but it was, again, a true honor to be recognized and to have those players behind me cheering me on was pretty neat.
How much pride do you take working with a team in a community like Brandon that is one of the smallest to have a Canadian Hockey League team?
Well, I think, like I said, this is a real community team. Like, they are well known in this community and everything else. So again, when these guys can do what they do and get recognized for doing it, I think that the whole community is behind them and I get to be a part of that. So I take real pride in that. I'm proud of these players because I get to see them, you know, maybe in a different light than what other people do. Sometimes I forget that they're 16 and 17 year olds because, again, they're doing so much. They're out in the community giving back so much. And they're in the public eye so much that, again, I just get to know them real personal. And it's a real honor and a privilege for me to get to know these players like this. And especially to see how many of them go on to do such great, amazing things.
Well, Glenda, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today, taking time into your busy schedule. Congrats again on this big honor.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your time as well.
Well, thank you very much for listening to the CJOB Sports Show podcast. If you like what you heard, guess what? You can hear more every weeknight on CJOB from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Thanks again for tuning in. Subscribe if you'd like. We're available on iTunes and other places, I'd imagine. So farewell. Until we meet again.
Come on and thanks for all the fish. So sad that it should come to this. We try to warn you all.